Well, this news comes in from Kenya about their elections and about the violence. And then, of course, today the concern is a lot of displaced people without food. There's not a shortage of food in the country. There's a shortage of food being able to get to the people who really need it. It's difficult to sort out why this happened, what's taken place. And, of course, it not only affects the general population, it also affects the Christians there in Kenya. Sally Henriksen joins us here for the next few minutes of the program. She's Material, Medical Goods, and Resource Coordinator for LCMS World Relief. She just returned from her third trip to Kenya. Sally, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tad.
Okay, when did you get back into the States?
The end of October.
Okay, so you missed the election and the violence that followed after that.
Right.
When you left Kenya, what were the facilities like there that you had been working in and around?
Okay, we just had our grand opening, so to speak. We had our opening ceremony ribbon cutting for the medical clinic that we had funded, provided a grant for the ELCK to build to supply the people of the Kibera slums with medical care. So we had newly renovated a portion of the church to where there was a counseling room for AIDS. There was an area for a dispensary for medication. We had facilities complete with beds and desks and partitions for about four examination rooms, a small lab area with a sink, and newly renovated bathrooms, much to the excitement of the medical volunteers because they were really nasty. And so this is what we had just completed, and we had a medical camp there and the grand opening ceremonies for the church for this facility.
Okay, then came the presidential elections, if I'm not mistaken, in Kenya.
Mm-hmm. Well, and things were already heating up when I was there in October. There were time when the team was going from the facility to the guest house where we stayed in another part of Nairobi, and there were thousands of young men without their shirts on blowing whistles and waving shirts in the air and chanting for the ODM Orange Party candidate because he was from Kibera. So it was already starting to breed excitement for the elections back in October.
What happened at the elections, and then why the violent reaction that we've seen in Kenya?
Okay, one thing you have to understand about, I think it's sometimes hard for us as Americans to understand a third world country and how people think and react. Kenya actually has been held up as a model for the continent, and that's why this is so sad, because they're like the only country that has not been torn by civil strife and unrest, that for the most part they were participating economically in the global economy. Their tribal groups were able to get along for the most part. So they're a young country, but in the 40 years that they've been, this was 1963, I think, is when they received their independence from the crown, that they've been a well-functioning model and looked upon highly by the rest of the continent as a good example of how things should be. So that makes this even more sad, how this event happened. But of the 43 tribes, the one candidate is from the Kikuyu tribe, which is more central Kenya, but also have people in Nairobi, and that's the incumbent, Kibaki. Challenger for the ODM, or the Orange Party, he was from the Luo tribe, and it's near the Lake Victoria region, but they have a large constituency in the Kibera slums, people that came from that area to Nairobi looking for work. So you've got these two different tribes. The challenger was seen as kind of like, for us as Americans, as the outsider, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You know, the average Joe, he's going to fight corruption and make things better. So it gave the poor people in the slums, a lot of hope. Well, then what happened, the election came around on the 27th of December. It looked like he was going to win. And then at the last minute, all of a sudden, the incumbent wins by, 100,000 votes, which even the international community is questioning. Then the incumbent, Kibaki, turns around and has himself sworn in immediately, and not waiting like our system. You have a waiting period and then the president's sworn in. It's the same there. So that even gave more credence to their concerns that it was a fixed or a rigged election. So the people in Kibera, the only thing a Kenyan really has is the right to vote. So many people, the poverty rate is, unemployment's 40%. The average salary's about $400 a year. So if the only thing you have is the right to vote, and now you're feeling you've been cheated on that, you can start to understand how people got upset.
So we're talking about young men, not to justify anything that was done after mm-hmm. the, but we're talking about young men who have really nothing, no jobs, nothing to do, living in the kind of poverty that none of us here can even imagine.
Right.
And I wanted you to talk about that in a moment. A violent reaction, and an indiscriminately violent reaction to what they thought was a rigged election. You have some pictures sitting in front of you that our listeners obviously can't see, but you talked earlier about the facilities that you left behind there, the clinic and the renovated parts of the church. What's it look like now after the violence?
Think of post-World War II. It's basically the walls, part of the walls are standing to the church. The church is basically gutted. The cross in the front is charred. It still hangs on the wall. The altar's gone. You know, there's nothing inside. The clinic has been reduced to rubble. The looters came in. They stole all the medication. They stole all the equipment. I mean, everything. The blood pressure cuffs, the scale. I mean, everything is gone. And it's just rubble on the floor. And there was also a nursery school or what they call a nursery school. It would be a young elementary or like early childhood center. That's destroyed, that was on the property. The parsonage, luckily, no one was living in it. It needed some renovation, so it was not habitable at the time. The parsonage is destroyed. There's nothing there.
And this is just a microcosm of the destruction that took place generally around Nairobi.
Right, and it's in pocketed places. It's mainly around the slums. It's not like all of Nairobi. Nairobi is a huge, huge city. You know, probably 3 or 4 million, you know what I mean? By third world country standards, it's huge. It's very densely populated. So it's not all over, but it was pocketed mainly where these two tribes were in contact with one another. And then also in Kisumu, which is about 6 hours west of Nairobi, was heavily damaged and looting. And the little roadside kiosks, they have these little like shanties thrown up that where the average Joe gets their produce and food, they're gone. They just torched them all. You see guys with machetes and spears and that's it. I mean, so people are hiding for their own safety. At one point in Kisumu, there were people staying at a center right by the police station because they felt so unsafe, like 2,000 people with not even a blanket to keep warm, you know, just hanging out because they were afraid of the unrest that was going on.
So the general population is just terrorized by this.
Right, right.
The news that I saw before I came on the air, the latest from Kenya, really focuses on the fact that the situation is still so unstable that even the food that's in the pipeline, so to speak, to help with people who are displaced or refugees or just hiding out, can't get where it's going. And the hunger and actual starvation is starting to set in for some
right,
of these people.
Right, because now you've got kids running around on the streets, you know, I mean, small children because there's no food. The Mombasa port is jam-packed with containers, shipping containers with food and supplies, but they can't get out. And the other thing is Mombasa is a port not just for Kenya, but for some of the surrounding countries as well, so there's fallout. So I think that's why Desmond Tutu came to the country and that there's pressure from other places. I think the president of Ghana came in to try to get them to stabilize, or the political people to start looking at things before they bleed the country to death. So, they have the things in Mombasa, but they can't get it out on the roads because the roads aren't safe, you know. So people are separated. Some of the church people that I talked to this morning, like one of the church leaders' family is in Nairobi. He's stuck in Kisi, which is, you know, hours away. But he can't get back because of the roads. He doesn't have internet access there. His minutes are gone on his cell phone, and they do the, you know, pay-as-you-go thing. So getting minutes is not an option because there's no place to get any.
So this is, I mean, I'm trying to piece this together in my mind. this is kind of unimaginable in its present state. I want you to speak briefly, if you would, before we go to the phones, about this everyday situation when there isn't political unrest for those who live, some of them their entire lives, in the Kibera slums outside of Nairobi.
Folks come to Kibera. They end up going to Nairobi looking for work. Keep in mind, it's 40% unemployment. So you figure if you're out in the boonies somewhere, you hear that, well, maybe I'll have a better shot at getting a job in Nairobi. Well, they get there and they don't. So then you got no place to go and no money, so you end up in the slums. The slums has little kiosks and little businesses that have been carved out by the people who live there. It's almost like its own microcosm city. Out of anything they can find, they root through the garbage and they find stuff that they can sell. The standing joke is you can't have a metal sign in Nairobi too close to Kibera because it'll be down in part of somebody's house or store in, you know, about a half a second. So you'll see people bathing on the side of the road, washing cars for money, digging through the garbage, whatever they can to eke by.
And this is a huge slum.
Huge. Over a million people.
It's hard to believe. Hard to believe.
So, like, a St. Louis city right now, I think, is only, like, the real population of the city proper, I think, is only 400,000. So double St. Louis city proper. And it's and very compact. So then you have that. The other thing, too, is that on my last trip, one of the nurses fell in love with a little girl who was very, very small and tiny. She was so cute. I thought she was maybe about a year old. It turns out she was five, an orphan. But she said, I want to adopt her. So Dennis and Lorna Meeker, Dennis is the pastor there at Kibera, went and visited the family, or went to the school and found out more, and found out she had three siblings, visited the relatives in the slums that were living in a 10-by-10 house with their own five children and these four orphans. Well, Dennis spoke to the nurse. She's adopting all four kids. She's going to support all four of them. Dennis baptized the kids, including the infant cousin, and now the parents are willing. They're coming to instruction class at Kibera. So they're doing wonderful work there, and it's, you know, that he and Lorna have just ministered to people so well there that it's a shame that this happened.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, talking with Sally Henriksen about post-election violence in Kenya. She's just returned from her third trip to that African nation. Steve is up first, calling from his car. Hi, Steve.
Hi. It sounds like what you're describing is just the same type of ethnic or tribal violence, maybe to a lesser scale, that we saw in Rwanda in the last decade. And one of the questions that always occurs to me is, from a Christian's perspective, how do we teach forgiveness?
That's a great question, Steve. Thank you very much. In a tribal culture, how do we communicate forgiveness, especially between warring or factious tribes?
Well, and that's a neat thing, because when I talked to Dennis, there's been articles that Dennis has been quoted on the secular media. We have some things on our website as well. If people want to see pictures of the church before and after, et cetera, they can go to our website and get the latest updates. But Dennis told his people, they met for church. They had to cancel church a week ago Sunday, but this past Sunday they worshiped in the ruins. They had the sacrament. He told his people, 80 people showed up, we need to forgive those who've done this to us, and we need to keep on and sharing our faith and helping those that are in our midst and that are in need. The guest house where the doctors normally stay had, as of this morning, 47 additional people there. It only sleeps 14. And these were church members and people from the community that had no place to go and needed a place to be safe and stay for a while.
So the gospel of Christ's forgiveness for us, and that forgiveness lived and extended through us, can take root even in a highly volatile tribal culture like this.
Yeah, it can. And, I mean, I've seen the work of the gospel in Kibera. I mean, we had six baptisms the Sunday that our in October when our medical team was there. You know, the people, when you have nothing else, the gospel is so much more appealing because you don't have all the other material gods that we have here in the U.S.
Millie's listening in South County. Millie, thank you for being patient.
I asked earlier if this was our church or we belong. The ones that we work with also, because I read the account, which was better than it was in the Post-Dispatch in the USA Today, and it just didn't say that it was our church. You know what I'm saying? And it was a good write-up about it, but I was told that by Jeff that it was our church.
Thank you very much, Millie. We're talking about, at least in the case of our conversation, a church that's located in Nairobi, a Lutheran church there, that's a member of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Kenya. Am I correct?
Correct. The Evangelical Lutheran Church of Kenya is one of several Lutheran church bodies in Kenya. It is the one we are in partnership or fellowship with. They are mainly a rural-based church. However, they do have three congregations in Nairobi. One is the cathedral, which is right in downtown Nairobi in the church's headquarters. One is in the Kangwari slums, and the other is Spring of Life in Kibera slums. It is our partner church, and it's also a project of LCMS World Relief and Human Care, because LCMS World Relief and Human Care had sponsored building the medical clinic and providing, through volunteers, medical expertise to see patients there in the slums. So it's not an LCMS church per se. It's an ELCK church, but it has strong ties to us through the World Relief and Human Care projects.
You mentioned the ELCK. Bishop Walter Obari is the bishop of this of that national church. And I wonder if you've had some communication with him through the office and what he is asking for from our listeners.
Well, I haven't spoken with the bishop. I have had emails from John Halaki, who's the general secretary of the church, David Chuchu, who is their like social ministry project coordinator, and Dennis and Lorna Meeker, who Lorna is a Fort Wayne trained deaconess who is a native Kenyan, and her husband Dennis Meeker is a new pastor, second career fellow, who was just installed in September at Kibera. So talk about your
baptism by fire.
Literally baptism by fire. He had only been in the parish about 2 months, but They strongly requested the prayers of the church and their brothers and sisters for peace to reign in Kenya, and also for the support and, you know, the emotional support for the people that they themselves. I talked to Dennis and Lorna this morning, and I mean, everything's gone. And I said, Dennis, is there anything you really need, you know, that I can get for you? What do you really need? And you know what he said to me? A chalice. I mean, here's a man who's got nothing. And what does he want? He wants a chalice so he can commune his people. So right now, that's my goal, is to try to get him a chalice and get it shipped over there. I have a way to get it over there that I won't reveal, but I know I can get it over there.
You have a way to get it to him past all of the roadblocks that exist.
Yeah. That part I've got figured out. It's just getting the chalice. So I want to get a chalice and send it over there. But right now, World Relief and Human Care, if you want to donate, we're excited to have anybody that wants to help. We're focusing right now, your donations will go to immediate needs, food, shelter, clothing, whatever the church needs from us. And when I talked to Dennis, he said they're not going to push us out. I want to rebuild. So it's real exciting to see. Lorna said those criminals thought that the church was that building. She said, but the church is the people and the word and sacraments, and we're not going away. So, and the congregation there, the elders are very strong, and they want to rebuild, and they want to be a presence in the poor community and serve the poor.
Talk a bit about another facet of this we haven't discussed in this conversation, and that is the prevalence of AIDS. It's called a pandemic throughout most of this part of sub-Saharan Africa. And, of course, that is also something the scope of which is difficult to grasp. How would you describe it?
It's hard for people to understand that, you know, everybody, I mean, it's just, and I'm not exaggerating, everybody has orphans living with them, because we've lost a whole generation of people, about 25 to 40 for the most part. Pastor Chuchu, whom I work with, has 5 orphans in addition to his own 4 children. That's pretty much the norm. So think of, and from a tribal culture, that say you, Todd, if your brother was married and had children, and he and his wife passed away from AIDS, it's not even a question. Those kids are yours, period. So now your sister contracts AIDS, and she and her husband die. those kids are yours. So there's people that have 10, 20 kids they're responsible for, and people that are already in 40% unemployment, that stretches your resources.
The children also have AIDS in many cases, contracted from their parents, often at birth.
Mm-hmm.
You had a picture of one little guy who,
Oscar,
who's the first picture you showed me, skin and bones, and the next picture you showed me, he looks kind of fat and healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Just tell the story briefly.
Oscar is like one of God's miracles. He is the same age as my daughter. He's 12 now. He's cute as a button. He's one of my best buds when I go over there. Both of his biological parents died of AIDS. His father remarried prior to his death, infected the new wife who had AIDS and didn't want to take care of Oscar, and basically booted him out. And he was literally death warmed over. He was a skeleton with skin over it, and that was about it. If you could see the pictures, you wouldn't believe it. His sister carried him into the clinic in Dago, which is a rural area. It's very poor, but the ELCK has a women's center there. And it was fortunate for Oscar that Anita Scribner, who's one of the American docs that goes over with us, is an HIV specialist, was there and treated him and got him into treatment in Kenya. And he's had some rough times. The time before last when I saw him, he was doing better, but he had a tumor on his tongue and he wasn't able to go to school. And they started injecting the tumor, and after the first injection, they went back and it was just gone. The doctors couldn't understand it. And he lives with Dennis and Lorna now, and he is so healthy now and chubby. He's got meat on his bones, and he's in school. So that's the World Relief dollars and God's love at work.
Folks, Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief are doing great and difficult and long-term work in Kenya and elsewhere. Find out about their efforts at our homepage tonight. Go there, issuesetc.org. Or call 1-888-930-4438. In addition to your prayers, your help is much needed in Kenya. 1-888-930-4438. It's an international relief agency concerned with both body and soul. Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. Sally Henriksen is material, medical goods, and resource coordinator. Very big job for LCMS World Relief, and she just returned from Kenya. Thank you for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd, for having me.
When we come back from this break, we're going to round off the last half hour of the program, going to 6 o'clock. Am I right? I've got my sheets all mixed up. Yes. We're going to be talking with Pastor Amir Khan. He's pastor of All Nations Lutheran Church in Troy, Michigan, going from the African continent to the Middle East to Pakistan, where recently one-time leader of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto, was assassinated. There are all sorts of questions and investigations swirling around this assassination. Of course, the question has to do with what role did the Taliban play and all those kind of natural questions. We're going to talk with Pastor Amir Khan, a native of Pakistan, about that situation there and getting his thoughts in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. We also invite your thoughts and your comments, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850. We're coming to you live this Monday, January the 7th, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Friday on the program, the moral and legal arguments against abortion with Dr. Frank Beckwith. This is a must-hear 2 hours with Dr. Frank Beckwith, perhaps in defending life from beginning to end, one of the better hours we've ever done on Issues, Etc. It's coming up Friday. We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. Regular guest Dr. Carl Fakencher on good reasons to become a pastor.
Before I went to the seminary, I worked in business for a number of years, but I realized that the aspects of my jobs that I appreciated the most were the opportunities to be helpful and encouraging and supportive of the people who worked with me. It was quite clear to me that the way I could be most helpful to them was sharing the good news of Jesus Christ, their Savior. And I realized that if I became a pastor, that would be what I'd do all the time. The help that I could bring would be the help that was not just for today or tomorrow, but eternal.
For more information on studying for the pastoral ministry, look for the logos of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, and Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, on our homepage, issuesetc.org, preparing Christ-centered, cross-focused pastors for the 21st century, Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, and Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne.
Aborigines killed in the name of evolution. Answers with Ken Ham, a popular speaker and author from Australia. Well, you once told me, Ken, that Australian Aborigines were actually slaughtered and collected as specimens. Why?
Well, it's a sad fact of history, Mark, and it all had to do with evolution. You see, Charles Darwin believed that the Australian Aborigines were the missing links of evolution. And as a result, hunters came to Australia to kill the Aborigines and bring them home as specimens for museums. In fact, in the early 1900s, the Aborigines were listed as animals in a booklet from an Australian museum. There are many accounts of how various people hunted down Aboriginal men, women and children. They were killed like animals, skinned, and their skulls boiled down. The best specimens would be sent to America, England and Germany. It's also been estimated that perhaps 10,000 graves of Australian Aboriginal people were desecrated for specimens. It was an additional attempt for museums to prove the widespread belief that they were the missing link. And yes, many American evolutionists were also involved in gathering specimens of what they considered to be subhumans. The Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. holds the remains of 15,000 individuals of various so-called races. No wonder many people today still have racist attitudes, particularly when you realize that evolution is taught as fact throughout government education systems.
The evolutionary belief of an Earth that's millions of years old is tackled in one of our free booklets. Next time you're on the web, go to our website, answersradio.com.
Do you realize that one Bible translation says that if you do not receive properly the Lord's Supper, you will be damned to hell? And it's not an unknown Bible translation, it's the King James translation. On the next broadcast of Law and Gospel, we will show why English translations are quite deficient in dividing law from gospel.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
There's a reason why the address for AM 850 KFUO is Founders Lane. It's because we're always mindful of the original vision that our founders shared when they purposed to use the medium of radio to broadcast the gospel. That vision has not changed. What has changed is the number of competing and conflicted voices that confuse or compromise the gospel message. Our task is to proclaim the gospel as clearly as possible, free from historic or contemporary error. Our listeners and supporters tell us that they are grateful for the faithfulness of the message they hear on KFUO, and some have come forward to join our Founders Club so that we can continue our broadcast ministry. I encourage you to join those who are already members of the Founders Club. Your investment in the KFUO radio ministry comes to about $70 a month. And the KFUO staff shows its appreciation for members of the Founders Club by hosting the annual Founders Club dinner. This is Chuck Rather, and I'm hoping that you will join our Founders Club. Call me at 314-505-7831, and I'll arrange the details.
British detectives examine the scene of Benazir Bhutto's violent death. The visit comes amid continued controversy over the details of her assassination and the handling of the incident by Pakistan's police. A new examination comes despite a thorough clean-up of the area shortly after the blast. President Musharraf admitted it was unnecessary to have hosed down the area, but denied the move was an attempt to cover up evidence. He blames Al-Qaeda for the attack, but has failed to stop speculation that his government was somehow involved. TV pictures of Benazir Bhutto's last moments show her standing in the vehicle during the rally at Rawalpindi. Her widower has joined those accusing the government of playing a part in her death and urged Britain and the US to support calls for a UN investigation. Stuart McDill, Reuters.
That's a story from Reuters, the latest out of Pakistan after the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, or what's believed to be the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, the former leader of Pakistan. She was making efforts to gain a following again there and of course, was a controversial figure in all of her time of exile as well. Pastor Amir Khan joins us to discuss briefly the situation there, explain some of the details. He's pastor of All Nations Lutheran Church in Troy, Michigan, and a native of Pakistan. Pastor Khan, welcome back.
Welcome to you also, and thank you so much.
Who was Benazir Bhutto to the Pakistani people?
Yeah, people really loved her from their heart. You know, she was very popular among the middle class and lower middle class and poor people. And I think she's a great loss for the country and for the whole world.
Was it unexpected, Pastor Khan, that on returning to Pakistan, her life would be in grave danger?
No, it was very well, actually. I was talking to some other friends earlier when she was leaving, and I said that I think this is her last last days of her life, because she knew that there is a great threat for her.
Since the last time we talked about Pakistan, I remember at the time the President Musharraf was still wearing his general's uniform. He was still holding a commission in the army, in the Pakistani army. If I'm not mistaken, he's since resigned that commission. Why did he do that?
I think it was the pressure from the West, and that was the biggest mistake West has actually made, to force him to step down from the uniform.
Why is that a mistake?
Because actually in Pakistan, there, you know, the army has a strong role, you know, since its creation. And a lot of army officers, you know, who worked in Saudi Arabia for a long time have a good ties with the Saudis. And the fundamentalist group is also in the army. And Musharraf, controlling at that time, having a strong hand on these elements, but since they force him to step down, I think so. No, he doesn't have much power.
Can you paint the picture for us, if you would, Pastor, about what you perceive to be the relationship between the present government of Pakistan, the Saudi nation, and the more radical elements of Islam, in particular, the Taliban?
Well, what I see is that Saudi have a lot of interest in Pakistan, because majority of the madrasas are funded by Saudi government, and Propagation Center of Saudi Arabia is funding them, and they are spreading Wahhabi, school of thought. And the government actually gets oil and some other benefits from the Saudis, and this is how actually they have a strong relationship. And Saudi needs to have a good relationship with Pakistan so they can control and hold, you know, an Iranian threat also.
So are things on the right track, other than Musharraf kind of bending to Western pressure to break his association with the Pakistani army? Are things less stable, more stable now in Pakistan?
I think it's less stable now, and I don't think so. Musharraf has any power now to hold this seat for long term, or maybe, you know, to be more pro-Western, you know. I think the coming days will be more difficult for him also.
Is there any news as to when and if the elections will be held? Of course, Bhutto's assassination threw that all into question. What do you know?
You see, they should have done the election on the 8th, and now they are conducting on the 18th of February. So this time, actually, they will change a lot of things, you know, voter list and other things, and try to, you know, keep PPP or Nawaz Sharif out of the, you know, picture. And the Chaudhrys, actually, who ruled the Punjab for almost 5 years, they betrayed Nawaz Sharif earlier, and they are very dangerous people, these Chaudhrys.
Do you think that Benazir Bhutto was assassinated
because
she had a prospect of returning as a leader in Pakistan?
There is no doubt in my mind. You know, she was killed, you know. The thing was is that Saudi cannot see a woman, you know, in Pakistan ruling the country.
Why not?
Oh, it's more like, you know, the Islamic thing, you know. They don't see woman as a model role, you know, sitting on the throne and, you know, meeting them and conducting the business with the Saudis. And Saudi have a lot of interest in Pakistan, so that's why. And Benazir is always, you know, going against these people, because she doesn't want to have these fundamentalist, you know, people to grow in Pakistan. So that was, I think so, there might be some, you know, association with the Saudis also, involvement.
The news I read, Pastor Khan, is that Bhutto's son would try and take up her mantle and the leadership of the movement that she represented. What are your hopes there?
I think that he's too young. He does not have the qualities. We have not seen any quality in him. But the other biggest setback for PPP is that people do not like Zardari, Motarma Benazir Bhutto's husband. And majority of the PPP people, you know, they don't want to have any affiliation with him because he was the corrupt person during Benazir's time. And no, if people might think that if they will elect Bilawal, then the Zardari, you know, obviously be back in picture. So I think so that will hurt.
So what do you expect from the elections when they're held?
You see, if the elections are fair, PPP will definitely win.
If they're fair, you say?
Sorry?
If they are fair, then the party will win.
Yeah, the thing is that the machinery of government will not let, you know, one party to have a majority, you know, to form the government. So it will be like they will control it somehow.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on the situation in Pakistan, we're talking with Pastor Amir Khan, pastor of All Nations Lutheran Church in Troy, Michigan. He's a native of Pakistan. You can give us a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Pastor Amir Khan is pastor of All Nations Lutheran Church in Troy, Michigan, a native of Pakistan. And we're coming to you live this Monday, January the 7th. We were actually live with you on Thursday, if you noticed, but we're back here for this full week on Issues, etc., January the 7th. I'm Todd Wilkin, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. A little bit later in this last half hour of the program, we're going to bring you an NPR interview with the leader, one of the leaders of the National Association of Evangelicals on the 2008 presidential race, in particular the prospects of evangelical Mike Huckabee in the New Hampshire primary. It's coming up in just a few minutes. Well, a couple other questions. Pastor Khan, I understand that you're, if I'm not mistaken, your father holds a commission in the Pakistani Army as well?
No, it was not my father, my father's brothers and other relatives, they were.
And do you hear from them and their thoughts on the situation there in that country?
No, actually, nobody talks anything.
Really?
Yeah.
So what do you think is the best possible scenario, given the situation such as it is in Pakistan, for the immediate future? What would you hope to see for your home country?
You see, my biggest hope is that, you know, the economy is very weak. There is no education. And the biggest threat right now is that the fundamentalist group is recruiting people and training them and, you know, giving them food and other basic needs. And that can only be stopped if we have a very strong leader. And I don't see now anybody now, because Benazir had those qualities to do something. So I'm just hoping and praying, you know. Things can get better. Could be Nawaz Sharif. I don't know.
Let's take a phone call. Cindy's calling from South County. Cindy, thank you for waiting and welcome.
Thank you. Pastor Khan, how does a woman in a country that seemingly women pretty much take the back seat, how does a woman get to power and get to the position that she would have had?
You see, it's very difficult. In most of the Muslim countries. In Pakistan, Benazir really worked hard and she reached to the, you know, 51% population of Pakistan, which is the female, and they really elected her twice. And heavily they, you know, give vote to her. But it is very difficult. It's difficult, that's why twice they, you know, they throw her out of the government, and this time they were lucky enough to get her, you know.
One final question, Pastor Khan. If Osama bin Laden were discovered and apprehended either in Pakistan or some believe in Afghanistan, the border between the two, would this take the wind out of the sails of radical Islam in both of those countries?
No. Osama bin Laden definitely is in Pakistan. Waziristan are in the Kashmir border side. And it is not going to happen because Saudi has done a good job to, you know, develop many, many Osama bin Ladens in Pakistan.
Pastor Amir Khan is pastor of All Nations Lutheran Church in Troy, Michigan, and native of Pakistan. He joins us regularly to talk about the situation there. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Okay, God bless you.
And you as well. For the last few minutes of the program, we're going to turn our attention to matters domestic. We've been overseas for about the last hour or so. Of course, tomorrow is the big event. The Iowa caucuses were a big event, but New Hampshire is considered to be, well, I heard someone say this morning, it's the real deal because it's an actual voting situation in most cases. Everybody knows how it works, and of course, a lot of presidential hopes have been made or dashed in New Hampshire, even though the state is rather small and in some ways politically rather odd. No, nothing against New Hampshire, but it's not necessarily mainstream America. The big question is, of course, after Mike Huckabee so decisively took Iowa in its caucuses, what is he going to be able to do in New Hampshire? An entirely different animal, both politically and demographically, from that Midwestern state. No one says he's going to win it. I was looking at the polls on Sunday morning and watching some of the news, and he's down in the mid-teens. Maybe second? He seems to have momentum. Of course, some are saying that someone like Mitt Romney has to win New Hampshire. The whole question of can evangelical momentum propel Mike Huckabee through New Hampshire to the other primaries? It's a question that was brought up in an interview National Public Radio did with Richard Cizik. He's the vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals.
Honesty. I just want to know the facts, you know, whether it's good or bad, just tell the truth.
I'm looking for integrity, morals, ethics, all of the positive characteristics that it takes to be president of the United States.
I'd like to know what a candidate's opinion is on subjects like abortion. I'd like to know, you know, what they would, how they would carry that out, their opinion.
Honesty, morals, abortion, all are especially important issues to evangelical voters. Evangelicals in Iowa carried former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee to victory, but will they do the same in New Hampshire? Richard Cizik is here to try to answer that question, and more. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Leanne.
Will Mike Huckabee be as appealing to the New Hampshire evangelical crowd as he was in Iowa?
Maybe not as much. Let's face it, Iowa is populist territory, and Mike Huckabee is a populist. He's not a moralist. He's certainly not a culture warrior, and neither are Iowans. So he did very well there. But now he goes to the Granite State. The question is, will the themes that he kicked back and forth out there in the prairie pass for good Republican politics there in the Granite State? Live free or die is the theme there. And therein you have limited government, market-oriented capitalism defending conservatives who, well, they don't always like what populists want. Populists want more government influence, more regulatory power to help people. And so the kinds of themes he hit, well, for example, put it this way, out in Iowa, Mr. Huckabee said, every time Americans strive to rise, well, they're pushed down every time by their own government. That's, well, that's populism. Hmm. Might not pass for good politics.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the evangelical, though, the vote. Do you think, are there splits among those who consider themselves evangelical, or do they largely support one candidate?
Well, you saw the evangelicals go decisively in Iowa for Huckabee.
They weren't gonna
vote for Romney. Romney made a pitch, but he didn't quite sell it. He's kind of a manager like the present president, and people are looking for inspiration. A lot of evangelicals listened to that speech by Obama and said, wow, that man's an orator, and evangelicals admire oratory. After all, we are public communicators, and that's what, frankly, most of the nation wants, too. So Huckabee gained because he is that, a communicator, a former pastor. He's not an oppressive moralist, however, and so he's able to marry the two. You see, his economic populism with his concern for faith, morals, and candor, all the rest.
You mentioned that Mitt Romney didn't make much headway among evangelicals. What about Arizona Senator John McCain?
McCain is an interesting figure. He may well inherit the mantle if Romney falls in New Hampshire of the mainstream Republicans, even the Wall Street Republicans, even though he is, he's not the traditionalist either. And so some of those who dislike Huckabee here in this town, that's Washington, also dislike McCain. McCain's talking, well, about the environment. He talks about limiting special interests. Some of these are not traditional themes of Republicans. And so who is going to inherit the mantle? I think it's a split in the party.
And just briefly, South Carolina, any projection there?
I would think that Huckabee would do better in South Carolina than he would in New Hampshire. And so this is going to continue. It's going to be a fight for the soul of the Republican Party, no doubt about it.
Richard Cizik is the Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the National Association of Evangelicals, and he joined us in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Leah.
You know, so often the association is made, sometimes the equivalence is drawn between the Republican Party and this, what is often believed to be a monolithic voting bloc, evangelical voters or values voters. And I think what we're discovering here, at least in the very early days of the primary and caucus season, is that the two are not synonymous with one another. The two are not coterminous, Republican Party and evangelical voters. They're two distinct, different entities in American politics. And maybe I'm wrong, but increasingly less comfortable with one another. Now, I can't say I see that as bad news, because I think for too long American evangelicals have simply said, well, God's a Republican, he's got an R after his name, and if you're a good Christian and a good American, you're a Republican. None of those things were ever true, and maybe it's taken a rather wide race and a rather undecided electorate to kind of prove to evangelicals themselves that being a Christian and being an evangelical, being a Christian and being a Republican aren't the same thing. Our call in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you agree with Richard Cizik that Huckabee's got a row to hoe there in New Hampshire, but if he makes it past, he might get South Carolina, and we might see the end of Mitt Romney and the first possible Mormon president? Would you be comfortable with a Huckabee who emerged early in Iowa keeping his lead and perhaps facing the Democratic candidate for president in 2008? What would be your misgivings? What would be your hopes? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And not, of course, to be counted out, John McCain. Saw him on Tim Russert's show Sunday morning. Standard kind of questions being asked of him, but he seemed to present himself in an impressive way. He was being nice to both Huckabee and Romney in that interview. He didn't take out of any knives or do anything like that. And then I listened to the analysts on Russert's show on NBC as I was getting ready to go to church, and both of them called the race. They were asked to call the race now. And both of them said, after all the Huckabee dust has settled, it's going to be Obama versus McCain in 2008. You think they're wrong? I mean, these are people who've made their money consulting candidates and watching the polls, and they know how to read the tea leaves. They're not always right, but that's what they're saying. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issue ZTC at KFUO.org. And maybe, just maybe, since for some reason, we were talking with Terry Mattingly last week, and remember Terry Mattingly said, I can't figure out why values voters, evangelical voters, won't jump on the McCain bandwagon. He's everything they always wanted. He's everything they say they always wanted. And for some reason, they won't. And I suggested to Terry, do you think it has something to do with conservative talk radio just having an axe to grind against John McCain? And he said, yeah, he thought that probably explained most of it. And I've always wondered why evangelical voters don't say, hey, McCain is pretty much everything we've been looking for.
Well, the issue, I don't know how many of them do the research. The issue with John McCain, biggest issue, is his position on embryonic stem cell research. That's what he's had, 100% pro-life voting record until that issue came to the forefront.
Did he vote for federal funding for embryonic stem cell research?
Yes. Yeah, he's like the Orrin Hatch position. But if you recall, I don't know if you remember this conversation before we left for Christmas, what did I tell you?
Okay, I was trying to communicate this to my dad because my dad is always interested in what you think is going to happen because, of course...
Why?
Look, hold on. Because I've told my dad, you know, Jeff called the whole Joel Osteen thing. Jeff told us before anyone believed it, including me, that Joel Osteen was the next big thing. And lo and behold, he was. You also called John Kerry, if I'm not mistaken, before Kerry emerged in the last presidential cycle as the Democratic candidate, didn't you? I think you called him, didn't you?
I don't know if I did, but my political insights are my dad is a quintessential Reagan Democrat.
Okay.
So that's
that means a Roman Catholic who voted for Reagan, right?
Exactly.
Okay. All
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So, but what, I told you that it's going to be the ticket will be McCain Huckabee, if you remember, before we went on Christmas.
All right.
McCain at the top of the ticket. McCain would start. You could see him starting to come on strong, and the surge in Iraq has helped his cause, and.
It's keeping the Republicans from having to talk about Iraq.
And people like my dad are, you know, veteran-type people.
So you're viewing the election through your dad's eyes at this point.
Pretty much.
Saying,
it's like Tim Russert. You know,
what would dad do?
Right, Tim Russert. What's Russert's dad's name, the book that came out?
Big Russ or whatever his name is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's another Reagan Democrat in Buffalo, blue-collar, teamster. You know, that's my dad. So I think it's going to be McCain Huckabee. I think that's going to be the ticket. Don't put your money on. I have no.
All right, I took
three political science courses at the University
of Missouri.
But since
you're opining, and since you have a record of calling these things somewhat accurately, who would you make the Democratic ticket?
Well, I think the toughest one to beat is John Edwards.
You think it's an Obama Edwards ticket?
Oh, I don't know about that. That's a good question. Never thought about that. But I do think that. I think Obama's, the momentum he has now, and if you have the youth movement coming out the way they did in Iowa, and it appears they are in New Hampshire, I don't know how you're going to stop it.
I got to ask you, did you watch on Iowa caucus night, did you watch the acceptance speech, or the, what do they call it, not an acceptance speech, but a victory speech that Obama gave in front of that crowd?
No, but I heard the Morning Joe Scarborough, said it was one of the greatest political speeches.
It was Kennedy-esque. And, you know, I do not agree with probably 75% of what Barack Obama believes politically, the stuff that doesn't matter, that's just opinion, and in particular on the issue of life and on the issue of gay marriage, I disagree with him. But my wife and I were sitting there, no, it was my daughter and I were sitting there watching Barack Obama give that speech, and my daughter said something that only a 16-year-old could say. She said, you know, if I agreed with him, I could vote for him. Which was her way of saying, this guy is impressive. So who knows? It would be interesting because we had Terry Mattingly point out at the end of our conversation with him on Thursday that say what you will about the United Church of Christ, say what you will about the United Methodist Church, and say what you will about Baptists, and say what you will about Mormons, or I think in McCain's case it might be Presbyterians, these are devout religious people who are trying for the presidency. Issues Etc. was brought to you in part today by Concordia University St. Louis Center. Concordia University is designed for working adults, so the classes meet just one night a week. Find out more about them, 314-984-8840, 314-984-8840. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Concordia University St. Louis Center, professional education with a personal touch. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
To Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.